From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. I'm your host, Larry Kay from the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with Gary Wilcox from the Powhatan Nation. Today on Indigenous in the News, we welcome you to part one with James Parker Shield, founder and CEO of the National Native American Hall of Fame, a proud Little Shell Chippewa. Shield has dedicated his life to honoring Indigenous excellence, transforming a vision into a national institution celebrating Indigenous leaders, artists, and trailblazers. From journalism to public service to building the Hall of Fame, he continues to uplift stories that inspire Native communities across the country. Indigenous in the News starts now. I'm Larry Kay, and joining us from our Miami studios is Gary Wilcox. How you doing today, Gary?
Hey, we're doing great. Doing great right here in Miami, Larry.
Yeah, nice and warm. Keep it warm for us.
Right on. Join us today is James Parker Shield, the driving force behind the National Native American Hall of Fame. His Hall of Fame now honors Indigenous heroes from every field while providing educational programs that ensure Native achievements and remembered and celebrated for generations to come. We are excited to have you here today. Welcome to our show, James. Mm-hmm.
Welcome. Thank you. Welcome, James. Hello. Yes.
You know, and hello out there to all you skins in Indian country.
Yeah.
All right. So, James, let's get started. Can you share a little bit about just about your early life and how those experiences shaped your vision for the future?
Okay. Well, you know, I'm from Little Shell Chippewa and Cree tribes in Montana. I spent part of my youth on the Rocky Boy Reservation. I also lived in a Indian community that was outside the city of Great Falls. It was a little shanty town called Wiremill Hill. And my folks, my mom was the Little Shell Chippewa and Cree. My dad was Turtle Mountain Chippewa. And unfortunately, like most of the other people around us, they like to drink and they like to party. And sometimes they would basically ask people to watch us kids. There was three of us. And we'd, you know, they'd be gone for days at a time, or sometimes a week at a time, sometimes longer. And, you know, friends, relatives, strangers, it didn't matter. Somebody that would just walk the kids while they went out and had fun, I guess. And then one day when I was 5 years old, they never came back. So we found ourselves classified as abandoned kids.
Oh, no.
And we were put into foster homes and bounced around. And then ended up in the what used to be the state orphanage. Euphemistically, they called it, by the time I got there, the Montana Children's Center. But it was pretty much about 70% Native American. And there were whole families there, you know, I mean, kids, no adults, but, you know, five or six kids from the same family. And the stories were pretty similar to ours, you know, dysfunctional families and neglected kids and sometimes abandoned like us. So you end up in institutions like that. And that's where I stayed until the ninth grade. And of course, like a lot of other kids in that situation, especially Indian kids that were in an institution that was across the river from a rural white town that didn't like us, we didn't like them, and then we were, we had to go to high school in that town school. They, you know, it was very apparent that they didn't want us there and we didn't want to be there. So you always got in trouble, you always got in a lot of fights. And so no big surprise, at the end of my ninth grade year, I was asked not to come back. They expelled me from school. And so there I was, but I was still a ward of the state. So the folks at the Children's Center had to figure out what to do with me. and a couple of Creole kids, they got in trouble at the same time, got kicked out of school as well. So the three of us ended up getting shipped off to an all-Indian job corps at Kicking Horse on the Flathead Reservation in Montana. So I was one of the first 50 Indians that were was in this brand new job corps that was run by the people in the Flathead Reservation. And, you know, just played basketball, got on their boxing team, and actually got a GED.
Nice, nice. And, now, those were some struggles. How did they influence your path into leadership and service down the road?
I think the subsequent years, you know, they were pretty rocky as well. You know, when you're drifting around and sure. you're in and out of trouble, and I think the only thing that was a positive in all of my younger years growing up was that on the outside I was a troublemaker and getting in fights just to stand up for myself. I always thought. I was never a bully, but I was kind of short for my age. And but really, on the inside, I was a closet bookworm. You know, I read all the time. And of course, back in those days, in the early 60s, there wasn't a large amount of material out there about Native Americans or, you know, Native American individuals. And so whenever I'd run across something in the school library, I would, you know, I would jump on it. So I read the books on Crazy Horse, Osceola, Chief Joseph, Jim Thorpe, of course.
My idol.
I mean, he was the only contemporary Indian role model offered up at the time. And on television, of course, was Tonto from The Lone Ranger of Tonto.
Oh, yeah.
yeah. And so... You know, but pretty sparse pickings as far as role models and inspirational figures. But still yet, you know, as a young Indian, that was at least something that you could hang on to and kind of look to. So we just didn't have it around. You know, even after I returned to my hometown in Great Falls, Montana, it was a big deal for me to see an Indian waitress working in a cafe.
Oh, sure.
You know, we didn't have high school graduates or college Indians. This was all before that ever started. Mm-hmm. And most, you know, pretty much everybody I knew in the Indian community dropped out of school or got kicked out of school, you know, around 9th, 10th grade. So what happened to me was no different. You know, I was just like everybody else. And the very first place that I saw a difference was when I made up my mind when I was 19. I thought, I want to get out and, you know, see the world a bit. And so I actually hitchhiked in the middle of winter. And I thought, I'll just head south, any place that's warm. And lo and behold, I climbed off a semi truck in downtown Oklahoma City. And nowadays they call it homeless, but I was looking for work. I was walking the streets, sleeping in the park and looking for dishwashing or swamping jobs and couldn't find anything. Certainly didn't have any education to speak of to get any, you know, good paying jobs, but I kept at it. And then I finally got into a trade school where I became a medical transcriptionist, they called it.
Oh, yeah.
It was my first fancy job.
Nice.
Yeah, transcribing doctor's orders, you know,
sure.
on patient charts. And that was here in Oklahoma City. And then I was running around with a couple of Kiowa guys, and I was constantly surprised and impressed by the Indians I met down here in Oklahoma, because they were light years ahead of our people back home. I mean, the first time I ever saw an Indian drive a new car was down here in Oklahoma. First time I ever saw an Indian wearing a suit and tie was here in Oklahoma. And I was meeting a lot of Indians down here that had college educations. In fact, I ended up going with a girl and eventually married her that came from a large family. She was the youngest of 13 kids. And all those kids were college educated, including her. Mm-hmm. And here I was, you know, pretty rough youngster from back in Montana. And it was eye-opening experience for me. And so when a couple of my friends suggested when they were going to go visit a relative of theirs that worked at the BIA in D.C., so they invited me along. I wanted to go see the world, so I wanted to see D.C. too. So I just jumped in and ran smack into another eye-opening experience for the next couple of years in Washington, D.C. And keep in mind, this is like at the height of the Indian movement, mm-hmm. early 70s. And I hit town. I ended up dating a gal there that was Hopi. Her mom worked at the National Congress of American Indians. And pretty soon I'm being introduced and hanging around people LaDonna Harris, who was married to Senator Frank Harris at the time. And she was a Comanche from back here in Oklahoma. Ada Deer had her Menominee Restoration movement going, and her office was right in D.C. There was a numerous, what I call, you know, storefront Indian organizations that were fighting for Indian rights. Mm-hmm. And of course, AIM was very active. And so I got to know, you know, all the AIM leaders, you know.
Nice.
Russell Means and Dennis Banks and the Belcourt brothers, and because they would come in and out of D.C. to propagandize their movement or raise funds or mm-hmm. rally the troops or whatever. Sure. So they were in and out. And at the same time, the Alaska Native Claims Act was being debated in Congress, and you'd see this delegation of people traipsing by, and it would be pointed out to me by one of my friends. They'd say, oh, that's the Alaskan delegation.
Right.
You know, so there was always, I learned that word delegation. That's a, you know, that back then that was an Indian word. That meant sure. Indians that come to D.C. and, you know,
important.
Lobby.
Yeah,
you know,
important.
Lobby. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're, and they were all lobbying for, you know, rights and retribution and land claims and
sure.
all that kind of stuff. So it was an exciting time. Probably the most important person in my life that I met was Ernie Stevens Sr. Mm-hmm. And Ernie Stevens Sr. was, as you may recall, was a important figure in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He was kind of like the rebel within the organization, trying to change that paternalistic organization from the inside. Him and, you know, Leon Cook and some other people, they called the six-pack that Commissioner Louis Bruce brought in. Mm-hmm. And then you had people fighting the battle from outside the system. And so it was very interesting times. And
nice.
I got to watch and meet so many of these different people, especially when Ernie Stevens kind of took me under his wing and kind of mentored me and would spend time talking to me. And his office door was always open if I came to stop by and see him. And so as a result of that, I decided I want to be like these people, you know.
Right.
I want to be an Indian that's fighting for our cause and make things better for my people back home. So I decided to go back to Montana and go on a straight and narrow, behave and go to college and get an education and try to become like some of these people that I admired.
Right. Yes.
James, so what was the turning point that led to you to create the National Native American Hall of Fame? Tell us a little bit about that.
Boredom.
Boredom?
Wow. Well, if you ever try retirement, you know, I retired.
Yeah.
And.
Okay.
Yeah, so
this
I was
later.
Living on,
gotcha.
Yeah, I'm living on Social Security, and I'm living out one of my things, my dreams I had always had when I was younger, was to, I always dreamt that if I ever hit the lottery, I knew exactly what I'd do. I'd buy a small ranch and, and be a cattle rancher. So, and so, you know, so I had a few acres north of town, and I got some cows. I built a barn and bought a little tractor and livestock trailer, and you know, and I was living my dream. But after I got done getting all that set up, I realized that I felt like there was something missing. And one of the things was that I think I was going through withdrawals from being what we used to, when I was younger, we used to call the older Indians, you know, tribal leaders or other organization, Indian organization leaders. We used to call them meeting Indians. Because that's all they seem to do is just go to meetings, right?
Meeting Indians.
And yeah, so
that's a good one. We gotta bring that up in our next AIM meeting, right?
Yeah, I like it. Well, little did I realize that over the course of, you know, my career, I had become a meeting Indian. You know, mm-hmm. You get on so many committees and boards and positions, and you're always going to meetings, or you're at home and you're getting phone calls all the time, and then you got to travel, you're always busy that way. And then all of a sudden, you decide to retire, and you know, everything slows down.
Sure, sure.
And you don't see a lot of people, especially if you're doing something like raising cattle. Right. Talking to us, you know,
hidden on the ranch.
Well, yeah, so I remember standing down by my barn, looking around at the mountains, and this nice scenery, and the cows. And I was happy with that, but I was thinking to myself, you know, I feel like I kind of walked away, and maybe there's something I didn't do. And I remember I had this Hall of Fame idea years before.
Vision. Good vision.
Yeah, you know, and I thought somebody would do it because it was such an obvious omission. I thought, how come there's not a Native American Hall of Fame? There's a Hall of Fame for everybody else. I mean,
Brian, absolutely.
There's not even a Hall of Fame for dog catchers, but not for Indians, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, well, somebody younger, you know, that has the energy, and especially somebody that has the contacts and the ability, mm-hmm. the national presence to, because this would take a national effort. It would have, because it's going to be a national organization. And mm-hmm. you know, you'd be talking about all these people that you read about, you know, in the Indian news or see on TV once in a while, and or maybe even they're in a book.
Yes.
And I thought, well, somebody's going to do it because it's so obvious. I mean, this is not, you know, I'm not inventing anything new here. You know, I'm just thinking somebody's going to do it. And nobody did it. And so another couple of years goes by, and I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking about it. And of course, the first thing I did was I thought about, well, realistically, would I be able to do something like that? And I thought, boy, it'd be a long shot because, you know, I'm a senior citizen now. And I have some notoriety in Montana, but outside of Montana, you know, nobody knows me. I've never done anything at the national level, hardly ever traveled out of Montana. And so I just didn't think, you know, I'd be the one.
Sure.
But finally, I decided, well,
let's do it.
Maybe it's a question of me being stupid enough to try it, you know. Maybe it doesn't take that, you know, maybe I look at the wrong set of skills here, the skill set, you know, maybe not being a great leader or national renown, well-connected, all that influential. No, what you need is somebody that's a senior citizen, not very bright, you know, just ignorant enough to try something that, you know. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. So I thought, well, I'll see what I can do. And so once I made up my mind, and then of course, then I had to start doing the paperwork, you know, getting, you know, your nonprofit status, you know, get state incorporated and all that. And I can remember my first victim that I targeted because I knew I needed a board of directors was a good friend of mine. You know, those are the low-hanging fruit, you know. Mm-hmm. So the president of Stonechild College up on the Rocky Boy Reservation was Dr. Nate St. Pierre. And unfortunately, the Montana Indian Education Conference was going on in Great Falls at the time. So I just went over to the hotel where they were holding it and waited for him to come out of where he had been just finished giving a presentation. I ambushed him in the hallway.
Yeah.
And we went and sat down on a bench in the hallway, and I pitched my idea to him, and he said, "Yeah, I'd like to help, James. What can I do for you?" I said, "I'd like you to be my first board member." And he said, "Okay, sign me up."
Great.
And
nice.
So I had my first board member, but like I said, you know, he was a good friend, nice guy, good-hearted, but he did believe in the concept of the Hall of Fame. One of the few people that I knew from the national level that he in turn had a number of contacts was Harlan Macasito, who had been the host of Native America Calling for a number of years, you know, a radio program out of Albuquerque. And I called him up and pitched the idea to him, and he said, I'm on board. And he's, "I'll help you recruit board members." And I said, "Great." So he got me some other national board members, and we were off and running.
Wow, I like that story.
So the Hall of Fame has honored many leaders, artists, athletes, activists. Which inductees' stories have especially moved you in some sort of way?
That's easy. I'd say, you know, three of them right off the top of my head. I mean, because one of the things that I always point out to people is that you don't need to be a famous Native American to be in the Hall of Fame. It's not a popularity contest. It's all about what you've achieved or what you've done that has been a significant contribution to Native Americans or even just people in your state or community. And so you can be somebody that nobody's ever heard of and still make it in the Hall of Fame if we feel that what you've done is significant enough. And so obviously my mentor, Ernie Stevens Sr., is in the Hall of Fame, but he's one of those people that was well-known, held some really big-time positions. So, you know, that's kind of more typical of the kind of people that we have in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of other people are people that, are people are surprised. One was Catherine Siva Sobel. She was from Morongo. And she dedicated her whole life to preserving her tribe's language. And she also established their museum, which was not a big, you know, place, but it also helped preserve their culture. But her language, you know, saving and preserving the Morongo language was very important. So that's one of them. The other one, this was back, I think, 21 or 22. We had star-laden group of people. We had Ben Nighthorse Campbell. We had Rick West. We had Joy Harjo. You know, I mean, we just had some real big names.
Nice.
Everybody. But there was one name there that was not a big name, but she made it through our process. And she was a nurse, an Indian nurse. But more importantly, she was a nurse during World War II, and she was at the Normandy invasion in a field hospital. And she was also at the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm.
And then she went home to South Dakota on her reservation. served her people for over 30 years.
Nice.
And, you know, she was quite the person. And
I'm like that.
Well, and then we find out that she's 102 years old.
Oh, wow.
And she's still alive.
Incredible. Wow. I like it.
You know, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I got a hold of her family and I talked to her daughter and her niece and they said, yeah, you know, her health is holding up. She's in a wheelchair. And I said, well, do you think she'd be able to make it down to the ceremony? And they said, yeah, she wants to come.
Nice.
And I would keep, you know, checking, you know, with them every few weeks to, you know, see how she was doing and if she was still going to be able to make it to the ceremony. And they said, you know, her health, you know, it's going down, but she's hanging in there because she's looking forward to being into the, inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah.
Love it. James, how can our listeners support the National Native American Hall of Fame and carry its mission forward?
Well, we have a website, nativehalloffame.org. People can go on our website and learn about our induction ceremonies, learn about our history. They can learn about each one of our inductees.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of fascinating stories.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's a donate button. Hit that donate button and hit it often.
There we go.
James, thank you for sharing your story with us today. Learned a lot of it. I learned a lot about the Native American Hall of Fame. That's awesome.
That's our book. We just came out with a Native American Hall of Fame book.
All right.
Yeah, it's got all the inductees in it. So, yeah, we're very proud of that. Thanks to the San Manuel Tribe, mm-hmm. California. They gave us the funding. And
right on. I love it.
It's been well received, and a lot of people signed up for it early at different conferences.
Where can we find that book, or where can our listeners find that book? Is it on Amazon, or?
No, we talked about Amazon, but we decided not to do that. We have it on our website, and you can order it there. You can pay for it there. You can also order it through Shopify.
All right.
Okay. All right.
Right on. Yeah. Well, James, thank you for your time today. I surely appreciate all the great work you're doing out there and honoring our people. Yes. Salute.
All right.
Stay in touch with us.
All right.
Have yourself a great week and safe journeys.
Today is part one of our interview with James Parker Shields. Tune in next week for part two for the whole story and the history of the National Native American Hall of Fame. Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous in the News and supporting us and our entrepreneurs. Indigenous in the News has been produced by Larry Kay. Our engineer is Paul Salvatore. Our theme music is composed by Lenny Long. Today's show has been recorded at the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida. If you'd like to support our program, you can stop by to donate on our homepage at indigenousinthenews.org. You can also find all of our past shows now on Spotify and iHeartRadio. Until next time, from all of us here at Indigenous in the News, have yourself a great week and safe journeys. Indigenous in the News is a production of Indigenous in Music and Arts.